Picture this. It's a Tuesday afternoon in the summer of 2026. You just got off work. You're feeling that specific kind of midweek exhaustion.
Oh, yeah, we all know that exact feeling.
Right. And you are walking into a gas station just to grab a sparkling water, or, maybe you're stepping into one of those trendy new botanical
The
bars.
ones that are popping up literally everywhere right now.
Exactly. Wedged right between the artisanal coffee shops and the yoga studios, or even just your local, slightly modernized smoke shop.
Right.
So you walk up to the counter, and there on the shelf, bathed in that really warm, curated lighting, sitting right next to each other, are two products. And they're packaged beautifully. I mean, earth tones, minimalist, modern fonts, matte finish pouches.
Little amber glass bottles with the dropper.
Yes, it looks incredibly high-end.
It really does. It looks like wellness, like health.
And they are both wrapped in the exact same marketing buzzwords. If you pick them up, you'll see words like legal or 100% natural, plant-based, and relaxing, just plastered right on the front labels.
Which is incredibly effective marketing.
Right, because to the average person, to you or me, just walking in off the street looking for a way to unwind without, say, having a glass of wine, they look completely interchangeable. Like you are simply choosing between a peppermint tea and a chamomile tea. It is presented as this pure aesthetic choice.
Which, frankly, is one of the most dangerous assumptions a consumer can make in the current botanical market.
Yeah. Go.
Absolutely. Because you are looking at two vastly different pharmacological agents, but the branding is telling you they're twins.
And that aesthetic deception is exactly what we are tearing down today, because the two plants inside those minimalist bottles and those earth tone pouches are kratom and kava.
Two very, very different plants.
Today, we're taking a deep dive into an incredibly revealing, meticulously researched breakdown from the ODTW Journal. The piece is titled Kratom versus Kava, Opioid Leaf versus Calming Root.
And that title really says it all.
It does. And the goal today isn't just to tell you these are different plants. Our mission here is to completely shatter the illusion that they are just, two sides of the same harmless wellness coin.
Because grouping kratom and kava together under this casual umbrella of natural chill-out aids isn't just a marketing stretch. It is a massive, highly consequential biological mistake.
So, what's the baseline here?
The thesis we need to establish right out of the gate, the fundamental truth that should guide how you look at that shelf, is this. One of these is a leaf that genuinely functionally acts on the exact same receptors in your brain as prescription painkillers.
Wow.
And the other is a root that works more like a mild plant-based anti-anxiety compound. One has the very real capacity to physically hook you. The other, biologically speaking, largely does not.
And this is exactly why you need to care about this. I mean, if you or a friend or a family member are reaching for one of these so-called natural relaxants to take the edge off a long week or manage chronic pain or social anxiety, you need to know exactly what biological machinery you are about to kickstart.
You really do. You have to know what's about to cross your blood-brain barrier.
Especially because the legal landscape surrounding these two plants isn't just changing. It is undergoing a massive, very quiet earthquake right now in 2026.
Yeah, regulators are finally catching up to the chemistry, and the hammer is coming down hard in ways the general public doesn't fully understand yet.
So we have botany, we have brain chemistry, we have corporate loophole chasing, and we have a very real developing DEA crackdown. Okay, let's unpack this.
To really understand why these two plants act so completely differently in our bodies and why regulators are treating them like night and day, we can't start in a laboratory.
Where do we start?
We have to start in the soil. We need to look at the botany and the generations of human history behind them. Because what's fascinating here is that the cultural history of these plants, how ancient civilizations used them, mirrors their internal pharmacology almost perfectly.
That makes total sense, actually. I mean, human beings don't just use plants randomly for thousands of years. We optimize them for specific societal needs.
Yeah. Exactly. Trial and error over centuries.
Right. So let's look at the first bottle on our hypothetical shelf, Kratom. The scientific name is Mitragyna speciosa. Where exactly in the world are we traveling to find this plant in its natural habitat?
So we are going deep into the tropical climates of Southeast Asia. We're talking about the lush, humid environments of Thailand, Malaysia, Indonesia, particularly the island of Borneo.
Okay, deep jungle environments.
Right. And a lot of people picture kratom as this little leafy bush, but Mitragyna speciosa is actually a tropical evergreen tree. And crucially, it belongs to the Rubiaceae family.
The Rubiaceae family. Okay, for those of us who skipped college botany, what else is in that family? Give us a hint.
Coffee.
Wait, coffee. Kratom is in the coffee family.
It is a botanical cousin to coffee, yes.
See, that right there is the kind of context that immediately shatters the modern marketing for me. When a smoke shop sells Kratom as this sleepy relaxation herb, knowing it's a botanical cousin to coffee immediately reframes it.
It changes the whole vibe.
Yeah, it suggests a plant with a bit more of a metabolic punch.
Exactly. And the indigenous history of Southeast Asia reflects that metabolic punch perfectly. Historically, in places like Thailand and Malaysia, Kratom is fundamentally a plant of labor. It is a plant of endurance.
Paint that picture for us. Who was using it and what exactly were they doing?
Imagine the rubber plantations and the agricultural fields of Southeast Asia in the 19th and early 20th centuries. The labor is grueling. It is backbreaking, physically demanding work, performed in sweltering, relentless heat and humidity.
Sounds miserable.
It was. So for generations, laborers would take the fresh, raw leaves of the kratom tree and chew them throughout the day, or they would brew them into a very strong, bitter tea.
So they weren't drinking this at the end of the day to wind down on the porch. They were using it as fuel.
Precisely as fuel. The primary purpose was to push through that intense physical labor. The workers used it to fight off fatigue, to numb the physical pain of repetitive manual labor, and to just endure the sun.
Wow.
Furthermore, in those tropical environments, waterborne illnesses were common. So kratom was also used to manage diarrhea and dysentery.
Wait, hang on. Diarrhea? How does a coffee cousin leaf stop dysentery?
Well, because of the opioid mechanism, which we will dig into shortly.
Right, great.
One of the classic side effects of opioids is severe constipation, because they slow down the smooth muscle in your gastrointestinal tract.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. So for a modern medical patient, that's a terrible side effect.
Mm-hmm.
But for a 19th century rubber tapper dealing with dysentery in the jungle, that side effect is a life-saving feature.
That is incredible. So it's like the ultimate blue-collar survival plant. It kills the pain, it gives you the energy of coffee, and it keeps your digestive system locked down so you can just keep working.
It is the ultimate laborer's tool.
Yeah.
But, you know, we also have to look at the darker historical thread intertwined with that labor history. In Southeast Asia, kratom was also historically utilized as a substitute for opium.
An opium substitute, like when the real thing wasn't around.
Exactly. In fact, in the 1940s, the Thai government actually banned kratom trees. They literally went around chopping them down.
Really? Because of the addiction risk?
You might think they did it out of a modern public health concern, but no. Historians widely agree it was primarily an economic move.
Oh, follow the money.
Always. The Thai government was levying heavy taxes on the opium trade. When opium prices got too high, people would simply wander into the jungle, pick kratom leaves for free, and use that to manage their opium withdrawals. Or just get a similar, albeit milder, effect.
Wow.
Yeah, kratom was cutting into the government's opium tax revenue.
So the government banned the free plant to force people back onto the tax narcotic. That is, I mean, that's fascinating. Yeah. But it also tells you everything you need to know about the potency of the leaf.
Exactly.
If an opium addict can use a tree leaf to stave off heroin-level withdrawals, we are not talking about chamomile tea here.
Not even close. You have this historical dual identity, right? The laborer's stimulant and the addict's opium substitute. Both roles are just baked into the DNA of how the plant has been used.
Okay, so if Kratom is this blue-collar, sweat-and-blood leaf of endurance and pain management, what happens when we look at the other bottle on the modern shelf? Kava. Where does kava come from, and what is its resume?
So to find kava, or Piper methysticum, we have to completely leave the jungles of Southeast Asia. We are traveling to the islands of the South Pacific.
Like where?
We're talking of Fiji, Vanuatu, Tonga, Samoa, and Hawaii. And botanically, it belongs to an entirely different family. It's in the Piperaceae family, which is the pepper family. It's related to black pepper.
And the vibe here, the cultural history is entirely different, right? Because you don't really hear about Pacific Islanders chewing kava while doing backbreaking labor in the fields.
No, you don't. Because if kratom is the laborer pushing through a brutal shift, kava is the diplomat. It's the peacekeeper.
Yes, the keeper.
Yeah. For literally thousands of years, kava has been a plant of peace, community, and deeply revered ceremony. Pacific Islanders haven't been chewing the leaves. In fact, the leaves are toxic.
Oh, good to know.
Yeah, they harvest the root of the plant, clean it, and then traditionally pound or grind that root to create a ceremonial earthy drink.
The famous Kava Circle. I feel like I've seen documentaries on this where the entire village gathers around this massive wooden bowl.
Yes, the Kava Circle. It's a foundational cornerstone of social, political, and spiritual life in these island cultures. It is deeply ingrained in the social fabric. You don't drink kava to build a house in the hot sun. You drink kava when the work is done, the sun is going down, and the community gathers to bond.
So it's highly social.
Very. It's used for hospitality. When a visiting chief or a guest arrives at a village, you sit down and drink kava together to establish trust.
So it's basically a social lubricant, but without the, well, the aggression of alcohol.
Exactly that. And that's why it is historically used for conflict resolution. If two families or tribes have a dispute, they come together, they prepare the root, and they drink kava.
And it calms things down.
Because of the pharmacological effects of the plant, yes, it lowers tensions, it promotes a sense of well-being and empathy, and it allows for calm, level-headed discussion. It is the literal passing of the peace pipe, just in liquid form.
I love that contrast. It is so stark. I mean, kratom is the coffee family leaf built for endurance, physical pain, and labor. Kava is the pepper family root built for social peace, diplomacy, and community bonding.
The contrast is amazing.
And earlier you mentioned that this cultural split labor versus peace mirrors what actually happens in our brains when we consume them.
It maps perfectly.
So let's lift the hood here. How exactly do these ancient cultural roles translate into modern brain chemistry? Because if I'm standing in that store looking at the word relaxing on both bottles, I want to know what biological highway each plant is taking through my nervous system.
This is the dividing line of the entire conversation. This is the single mechanism split that drives every other difference, every risk, every benefit, and every legal crackdown we are going to discuss today.
All right, hit me.
Let's start with kratom. Functionally, biochemically, structurally, kratom is an opioid plant.
Wait, I have to stop you there. I really want to push back on this because opioid is a highly loaded, terrifying word in America right now.
It is.
We are in the middle of a fentanyl crisis. Are you seriously saying that when a trendy wellness shop with neon signs and succulents in the window sells a kratom spritzer as a botanical boost, they are essentially selling a mild, unrefined opioid?
Yes.
How is that even legal?
I am absolutely saying that, and the legality is a massive loophole that regulators are frantically trying to close right now, which we will definitely get to.
Okay.
But strictly from a pharmacological standpoint, yes, it is an opioid. Let's break down the chemistry. The main active compounds in kratom are a class of chemicals called alkaloids.
Alkaloids, got it.
Specifically, the plant produces one called metrazogen and another far more potent one called 7-hydroxymetrazogen, or 7-OH for short.
Okay, so metrazogen and 7-OH, what do they actually do?
When you consume kratom, whether you drink it, swallow a capsule, chew the leaf, whatever those alkaloids enter your bloodstream, cross the blood-brain barrier, and they seek out very specific locks in your brain. Those locks are called the mu-opioid receptors.
The mu-opioid receptors. Just so we're entirely clear on the real-world context of this, what other drugs bind to the mu-opioid receptor?
Morphine, codeine, heroin, fentanyl, oxycodone. It is the exact same biological receptor system.
Hold on. If kratom is hitting the exact same brain receptors as heroin and fentanyl, why aren't we seeing people overdose on the dried leaf in the same way we do with prescription pills? Like, why aren't people dropping dead from chewing a leaf in Thailand?
That is a brilliant question, and it comes down to a vital pharmacological distinction between a full agonist and a partial agonist.
Explain that to me like I'm 5 years old. What is an agonist?
Okay, think of your mu-opioid receptor as a dimmer switch for a light in your dining room.
A dimmer switch.
Right. When you introduce a drug like heroin or fentanyl, they are what we call full agonists. They are like a person who walks into the room, grabs that dimmer switch, and violently shoves it all the way up to maximum brightness.
They crank it to 100.
Exactly. They activate the receptor 100%.
Wow.
That massive, overwhelming activation gives you the intense euphoria, but it also triggers the severe respiratory depression that stops your breathing and kills you.
Okay, so heroin shoves the switch to maximum. What does kratom do?
Kratom's alkaloids, particularly metrazogen, are atypical partial agonists. That means they walk into the room, they grab the exact same dimmer switch, but they only push it up about halfway.
Halfway.
And no matter how much kratom leaf you take, it chemically cannot push the switch all the way to 100%.
Ah, so it has a biological ceiling.
Exactly. It has a ceiling effect.
Mm.
This is why a fatal overdose from just consuming natural raw kratom leaf is exceedingly rare. It simply cannot activate the respiratory depression pathways strongly enough on its own to stop your lungs.
That makes sense.
But, and this is a massive, but just because it's a partial agonist doesn't mean the FDA isn't extremely alarmed by it.
Right. What does the FDA actually say about it? Because I imagine they don't love the idea of a partial opioid being sold next to Skittles at the gas station.
They absolutely hate it. To quote the FDA directly from the source material, they warn that kratom produces classic opioid-related effects.
Classic effects.
And they list them out very clearly. Sedation, nausea, vomiting, severe constipation, respiratory depression, and genuine physical dependence. Mm. When you activate the mu opioid receptor, even partially, that is the package of physiological effects you sign up for.
So the receptor doesn't care where it came from.
Exactly. The receptor doesn't care if the chemical came from a sterile pharmaceutical lab in New Jersey or a jungle tree in Borneo. It just responds to the key in the lock.
That is heavy. That completely recontextualizes what you're looking at in that botanical bar. You aren't buying tea. You're buying a partial opioid agonist.
Yeah.
Okay, so if kratom is taking the opioid highway through the brain, what is kava doing? If it's sitting next to kratom, claiming to be relaxing, but it doesn't touch the opioid receptors, what system is it hijacking to make me feel calm?
Kava takes a completely different route. Kava is a GABA plant.
GABA.
Yes. Its active botanical compounds aren't alkaloids. They are a unique class of compounds called cavalactones, things with names like cavein, dihydrocavein, and methistacin. And these cavalactones work primarily by potentiating your GABA receptors.
GABA. Gamma-aminobutyric acid. We hear that acronym thrown around in supplement marketing all the time. Let's break down GABA for the listener. What is this system doing in my body right now?
Think of the GABA system as the primary braking system of your central nervous system. It is your main inhibitory neurotransmitter.
The brakes.
The brakes. Your brain has excitatory chemicals that act like the gas pedal, glutamate, adrenaline, cortisol. They make neurons fire rapidly. GABA is the brake pedal. When GABA activity increases in your brain, your nervous system literally calms down.
So everything just slows.
Electrical excitability drops. It is the system that makes you feel relaxed, less anxious, less rigid, and physically looser in your muscles.
Okay, but when I hear GABA and anxiety, my mind immediately jumps to heavy prescription anxiety medications.
Sure.
Drugs like Valium, Xanax, Clonopin, those are benzodiazepines and they work on the GABA system, yeah. Right? So is kava just natural Xanax? Because Xanax can be highly addictive and dangerous.
This is a crucial, vital distinction. While kava and Xanax both work on the GABA-A receptor, they do not behave the same way. The GABA-A receptor is a complex, multi-part structure. It has different binding sites. Think of them as different parking spaces on the same protein molecule.
Okay, parking spaces.
Benzodiazepines like Xanax park in a very specific, highly potent site that forces the receptor to stay open, which can lead to severe dependency and withdrawal. Kava's cavalactones park in a completely different spot on that receptor. They modulate the receptor much more gently.
So it's tapping the brakes, not yanking the emergency brake?
Precisely. But kava doesn't just stop at GABA. It has a fascinating, multi-pronged approach to calming you down. In addition to GABA, cavalactones also block something called voltage-gated sodium and calcium channels.
Wait, slow down. Voltage-gated channels. What are those?
Think of them as the electrical gates that allow your brain cells to fire signals rapidly to one another. When you are panicked or stressed or having a racing thought, those gates are flying open, allowing electricity to flood through the network.
Like a busy intersection.
Right. Kava comes in and gently closes some of those gates, forcing your brain to literally slow down its processing speed. It quiets the neurological noise.
I love that visual. So it's boosting the chemical brakes, and it's physically shutting the electrical gates that cause racing thoughts.
And it does one more thing. It mildly inhibits an enzyme in your brain called monoamine oxidase B, or MAOB.
What is MAOB?
MAOB is like a chemical vacuum cleaner in your brain. Its job is to roam around and sweep up neurotransmitters, particularly dopamine, which is one of your primary feel-good reward chemicals. By inhibiting MAOB, kava essentially unplugs the vacuum cleaner. It leaves more of your natural dopamine floating around in the brain for longer.
So to synthesize this, kava is boosting the calming brakes with GABA. It's slowing down the frantic electrical firing by closing the voltage gates, and it's keeping a bit more of your natural dopamine around by unplugging the chemical vacuum cleaner.
Exactly. A beautifully orchestrated, multi-system approach to relaxation. And here is the absolute most important part of kava's mechanism, especially when comparing it to kratom. Kava has absolutely zero opioid activity. None.
Wow.
It doesn't even know what a mu opioid receptor is.
The core takeaway here is just so stark. Kratom quiets your system by pushing the opioid dimmer switch. Kava quiets your system by engaging your natural neurological brakes. They might both result in a feeling you describe as relaxed at the end of the day, but they are taking entirely different highways through your brain to get you there.
And because Kratom is taking that opioid highway, it behaves in a way that can be incredibly confusing and, frankly, quite deceptive for a first-time user who buys it, thinking it's just a relaxing tea.
Because of the dose dependency, the shape-shifting aspect we mentioned.
Exactly. Kratom is what pharmacologists call dose-dependent, meaning the subjective effect you get isn't just a matter of more of the same feeling.
Right.
It isn't like drinking one beer versus three beers, where you just get progressively more intoxicated in the linear way. With Kratom, the actual nature of the drug feels like it changes completely depending on how many grams of the leaf you ingest.
How does that work mechanically? How can one leaf do two opposite things?
It goes back to its roots in the coffee family and the complexity of that main alkaloid, mitragynine. Remember how we said it's a partial opioid agonist?
Yeah.
Well, it turns out it doesn't only hit opioid receptors. Mitragynine also interacts with serotonin, dopamine, and adrenergic systems in your brain.
The adrenergic system, adrenaline.
Right. So at low doses, let's say you take just 2 or 3 grams of the dried leaf powder. The concentration isn't high enough to fully engage the opioid system yet.
Ah, so what happens?
Instead, those secondary stimulant pathways are in the driver's seat. The adrenergic and dopamine effects take over.
So what does a low dose actually feel like for the user?
Users will report feeling a distinct surge of physical energy, increased alertness, and enhanced focus. They become very talkative, highly motivated, and they get a mild, productive euphoria.
It sounds like it feels like a very strong, mood-boosting cup of coffee. Or maybe a mild ADHD medication.
Precisely. You can immediately see why a rubber plantation laborer in Thailand would want this before a grueling 12-hour shift.
But then you cross a threshold.
You cross a threshold and the entire pharmacology flips. Let's use a mechanical analogy here. Think of Kratom like a dual-engine hybrid car.
Okay, I'm following.
If you keep it under 30 miles an hour, a low dose, it runs entirely on the electric battery. It's zippy, it's light, it's acting as a mood-boosting stimulant.
But when you press the gas pedal past a certain point...
The moment you press the gas pedal past that threshold, let's say you take 6, 8, or 10 grams of the leaf, the massive gas engine suddenly kicks in with a roar, drowning out the electric motor entirely. That heavy gas engine is the opioid effect.
So at high doses, the stimulant effect just vanishes?
It is completely overridden. At a high dose, the concentration of alkaloids finally saturates those mu-opioid receptors. The stimulation vanishes, and it is replaced by heavy physical sedation, significant pain relief, profound muscle relaxation, and all those classic opioid side effects we mentioned.
The nausea, the constipation.
Yeah, and the nodding off to sleep.
This is exactly why it's a shapeshifter and why it catches people off guard. If you buy a small Kratom seltzer, you might drink it and think, oh, this is just a nice herbal energy boost. It's totally harmless. I feel great. You might not even realize it has an opioid component until a month later when you decide to take 3 or 4 of them at once, or until you start taking it every single day and your body starts adapting.
And a massive number of people are taking it every single day. The data here is striking, and it highlights a very complex public health reality.
Yeah, let's look at the numbers. The source material notes that as of 2021, roughly 1.7 million Americans, and this is ages 12 and up, reported using Kratom.
That's a huge number.
1.7 million people. That is not a fringe underground community. That is mainstream. And the reasons they are using it are really a double-edged sword.
They absolutely are. When you survey these 1.7 million users, they are largely self-treating a variety of ailments because the traditional medical system has either failed them or priced them out.
Like what kind of ailments?
They're using Kratom for chronic back pain, for fibromyalgia, for severe anxiety, for treatment-resistant depression.
But there is one specific use case that stands out, right? The one that requires the most caution.
Yes. A massive segment of that 1.7 million people use Kratom specifically to self-treat opioid withdrawal and opioid cravings.
Meaning they were addicted to prescription painkillers like OxyContin or street drugs like heroin or fentanyl, and they are using Kratom as an off-ramp.
Exactly. They use it as a bridge to get off the hard stuff. And mechanically, biologically, it makes total sense why it works.
Because it's hitting the same receptors.
Right. Because Kratom acts as an opioid agonist, it fills those same empty, screaming mu-opioid receptors in the addicted brain. By filling those locks, it blunts the severe agonizing withdrawal symptoms of the harder drugs. It stops the shaking, it stops the cold sweats, it stops the bone-deep sickness.
It allows a fentanyl user to function and just hold down a job.
Exactly.
From a pure harm reduction standpoint, that sounds like a miracle.
Yeah.
If it keeps someone from injecting a lethal dose of street fentanyl, surely that's a win.
From a strict harm reduction lens, many advocates argue exactly that. It is vastly safer than street fentanyl.
Yeah.
But this raises an incredibly important, uncomfortable question that the botanical community often tries to gloss over.
What's the question?
If you are utilizing an opioid agonist to treat an opioid addiction, aren't you just swapping one physical dependency for another?
Are they? I mean, is it a free lunch?
It is absolutely not a free lunch. The answer, unfortunately, is a biological yes. You are swapping dependencies. Because kratom is acting on those opioid receptors, it doesn't just soothe past dependency. It is entirely capable of creating its own physical dependence.
Explain the biology of that. What happens when you take kratom every day for a year?
It's called receptor downregulation.
Receptor downregulation.
Yeah. When you constantly flood your brain with external opioid agonists like kratom, your brain realizes there is too much activity at the mu opioid site. To maintain homeostasis to keep things balanced, your brain starts literally removing opioid receptors or making them less sensitive.
Oh, wow.
It also stops producing your natural endorphins, because why should it manufacture its own painkillers when you are drinking them from a gas station bottle every morning?
So your brain physically changes its structure to accommodate the kratom.
Yes. Yeah. So when you stop taking the kratom, suddenly you don't have enough receptors and you have zero natural endorphins. The result is withdrawal.
That's terrifying.
You are trading a very severe, highly lethal opioid dependence for a milder, less lethal, but still very real kratom opioid dependence.
It's not a cure. It's a lateral move, or maybe a step down in intensity. You went from a roaring fire to a smoldering fire, but you are still shackled to the exact same biological mechanism.
Precisely. And that's a reality many well-intentioned users don't understand until they try to stop taking the mild botanical energy drink they bought at the smoke shop and suddenly find themselves experiencing genuine, undeniable opioid withdrawal.
All right, let's shift the spotlight back to the root of calm. Let's look at kava.
Let's do it.
If kratom is this complex dual-engine hybrid car flipping from stimulant to opioid and causing receptor downregulation, kava seems to be just a straight, steady, reliable line of calm. But I have to ask on behalf of the skeptical listener, does it actually work?
Fair question.
We know it hits the GABA system in theory, but is the science actually settled? Is kava a proven silver bullet cure for clinical anxiety?
That is the perfect question. Because the wellness industry loves to throw around the word clinically proven very loosely. To answer it, we have to take a very honest, nuanced look at the clinical data, because the evidence is actually quite mixed.
Mixed how? Let's start with the positives. What does the biology say?
We have undeniable biological plausibility. We know exactly how it works on the GABA and the voltage gates. We can observe in lab settings that it causes skeletal muscle relaxation.
Right.
We know anecdotally from thousands of years of Pacific Islander history that it creates a sociable calm while leaving your cognitive faculties entirely intact.
Right. You don't get sloppy on kava. You don't slur your words or lose your balance like you do on alcohol.
Exactly. Your head remains clear. But when we transition from biological plausibility to rigorous clinical trials for human anxiety disorders, we see two very different stories emerge from the data.
Okay. Tell me the first story.
On one hand, you have a major Cochrane review.
And for context for our listeners, Cochrane reviews are essentially the gold standard in medical research. They don't just do a new study. They gather all the available high-quality data from dozens of previous trials, pool the data together, and synthesize it to find the overarching truth.
Right. It's the ultimate meta-analysis. And this specific Cochrane review looked at kava versus a placebo pill for treating general anxiety.
And what did they find?
The conclusion was highly favorable. The review found that kava was, in fact, statistically superior to the placebo for reducing anxiety symptoms. Furthermore, and just as importantly, the reviewers noted that adverse events, side effects, were mild, transient, and infrequent.
So the gold standard review says it works and it's safe. That sounds like a home run for kava, but I hear a but coming.
But science is never that simple. Because later on, researchers conducted a highly rigorous 16-week double-blind placebo-controlled trial, specifically targeting patients diagnosed with GAD, generalized anxiety disorder.
A severe chronic clinical condition.
Exactly. A 16-week double-blind trial is serious business.
What?
The results were completely negative. Kava did not perform any better than the sugar pill for that specific clinical population.
Wait, how is that possible? How can the Cochrane review say it works, but a 16-week trial says it doesn't?
It comes down to the nature of psychiatric clinical trials, and specifically the power of the placebo effect in anxiety treatment.
The placebo effect.
Yeah, anxiety is highly subjective. Just the act of taking a pill, talking to a doctor, and believing you are being treated can cause a massive reduction in anxiety symptoms for a lot of people.
That makes sense.
In that 16-week trial, the people taking the fake placebo pill got so much better on their own that the Kava group couldn't statistically beat them.
Wow. The placebo effect is basically undefeated.
It really is.
So what is the final verdict here? If you are a listener dealing with stress or anxiety, and you are staring at that bottle of Kava, how do you interpret this mixed data?
The National Center for Complementary and Integrative Health, the NCCIH, which is a branch of the NIH, states it very plainly. They conclude that Kava does not appear to be helpful for treating the severe clinical symptoms of generalized anxiety disorder.
So if you have a diagnosed psychiatric anxiety disorder, Kava is not your medical cure.
Don't throw away your SSRIs. Do not replace your doctor's care with a botanical root.
Oh, good advice.
However, it is entirely fair and scientifically accurate to say that Kava has vastly more evidence as an anxiolytic and anxiety reducer than almost any other herbal supplement on the market today.
Okay, so it has its place.
It might not cure a clinical GAD, but for everyday tension, for situational stress after a hard day at work, or for mild social anxiety before a party, it has a real documented pharmacological effect. And crucially, unlike Kratom, it achieves this relaxation without the heavy baggage of physical addiction.
Which brings us to arguably the most critical section of this entire deep dive, the addiction and safety chasm. Because let's be real, people take risks with supplements all the time.
All the time?
If you are a listener considering trying either of these plants, this is what you absolutely must know about what happens when things go wrong. What is the worst case scenario? Let's talk about the addiction profiles first.
This is the sharpest, most defining contrast between the two plants. And if a listener remembers nothing else, this is the vital takeaway of our discussion today. Kratom causes real, physical, opioid-like tolerance and withdrawal.
We touched on this earlier, but I want to get visceral with it. What does that withdrawal actually look like? Are we talking about feeling a little grumpy, like a caffeine headache when you skip your morning espresso, or is it something worse?
It is profoundly worse than a caffeine headache. When a regular heavy Kratom user, someone who has been taking it daily for months or years, stops abruptly, they experience a constellation of symptoms that directly mirror traditional opioid withdrawal, even if it's generally lesser in sheer intensity than heroin withdrawal.
Walk us through the symptoms.
We are talking about severe irritability and aggressive mood swings. Deep, throbbing muscle and bone aches, as if you have a terrible flu.
Ugh, awful.
Severe insomnia. Users will go days without sleeping. Runny nose, tearing eyes, and intense, relentless cravings for the plant.
Wow.
And one of the most common, maddening symptoms is restless leg syndrome, where your nervous system is firing so erratically that you physically cannot keep your limbs still at night.
That sounds like absolute torture.
It is a physiological rebellion. The body has adapted its entire neurochemistry to the presence of an exogenous opioid, and it violently rebels when that chemical scaffolding is removed.
The source material even mentioned something that completely stopped me in my tracks when I read it. Neonatal withdrawal.
Yes. This is perhaps the darkest proof of Kratom's opioid nature. The FDA has documented multiple cases where infants born to mothers who were heavily using Kratom during pregnancy experienced neonatal abstinence syndrome.
Meaning the baby is born addicted.
The babies were born physically dependent on the Kratom alkaloids that cross the placenta. When they were born and the supply was cut off, the infants had to go through genuine, medically supervised opioid withdrawal in the NICU.
That's heartbreaking.
They experienced tremors, inconsolable crying, feeding difficulties, and hyperactive reflexes. That medical reality tells you absolutely everything you need to know about the biological power of this plant. It is not a harmless herb.
That is extremely sobering. That completely shatters the harmless tea narrative. Okay, let's pivot to Kava. What is Kava's addiction profile? If I drink Kava every day for a year and then suddenly stop, what happens?
Almost nothing.
Really?
Really. Across decades of safety literature and thousands of years of indigenous use, there is essentially no documented phenomenon of a Kava withdrawal syndrome.
That's a huge difference.
People can drink it heavily, stop cold turkey, and while they might miss the psychological feeling of relaxation, they do not get physically sick, their bones don't ache, they don't get the cold sweats, their receptors haven't downregulated in a way that causes a physiological crisis.
The analogy that comes to mind, and tell me if this tracks, is that kratom fails the way a hard drug fails, while Kava fails the way a bad diet supplement might fail.
That is an incredibly apt analogy. The failure modes, what happens when you abuse them or take way too much or buy a terrible product, are completely distinct.
Let's break down kratom's physical dangers first. Aside from the severe addiction and withdrawal, what are the physical risks of abusing it?
The FDA flags several major acute concerns with heavy kratom abuse: liver toxicity, drug-induced seizures, and the development of a severe substance use disorder that ruins lives financially and socially.
Right.
Beyond the drug itself, because it's a largely unregulated gray market industry, there is a massive issue with product contamination.
Meaning you aren't just getting kratom.
Right. State health investigators routinely pull kratom products off gas station shelves and find them tainted with salmonella, heavy metals like lead and arsenic, and occasionally adulterated with synthetic drugs to make them feel stronger.
Okay, but I have to ask the ultimate question regarding opioids. The American opioid crisis is defined by a horrific body count of fatal overdoses. We see the tragic numbers every year from fentanyl. Can you fatally overdose on kratom leaf?
This is a crucial, nuanced scientific point that often gets lost in the media panic, and it's important to get it right. Fatal overdoses from consuming natural, unadulterated kratom leaf in isolation are extremely rare.
Why? If it's an opioid, why isn't it stopping people's lungs?
It goes back to that partial agonist dimmer switch we discussed earlier.
Mm-hmm.
But there's another fascinating biological mechanism at play called G-protein biased agonism.
Okay, we're getting deep into the chemistry here. Translate G-protein biased agonism for me.
When a drug hits the mu-opioid receptor, the receptor can send two different signals into the cell. One signal travels down the G-protein pathway, which causes the pain relief and the euphoria.
The good stuff.
The other signal travels down the beta-arrestin pathway, which is the pathway responsible for the dangerous respiratory depression, the thing that stops your lungs.
So one signal is the reward, the other signal is the danger.
Exactly. Heroin and fentanyl trigger both signals equally. You get the pain relief, but you also get the respiratory depression. Kratom's alkaloids are biased. They heavily trigger the G-protein pain relief pathway, but they largely ignore the beta-arrestin respiratory depression pathway.
That is fascinating. It flips the pain switch, but it mostly leaves the breathing switch alone.
Exactly. Which is why, on its own, it struggles to cause a lethal overdose.
But wait, if that is true, why are there autopsies and medical examiner reports citing kratom in overdose deaths? Where are those bodies coming from?
The dominant danger, the primary overwhelming driver of kratom-associated fatalities, is polydrug use.
Mixing it.
Yes. It is when users mix kratom with other central nervous system depressants.
Like alcohol.
Alcohol, prescription benzodiazepines, or other full agonist opioids. Kratom on its own might only depress your breathing by 15%. But if you add alcohol, which depresses it by 30%, and a Xanax, which depresses it by 40%.
Ah, it stacks.
Suddenly, the respiratory depression compounds exponentially. The synergy is lethal. When medical examiners find kratom in the blood of an overdose victim, they almost always find other depressant drugs right alongside it. It is the mixture that is the killer.
Do not mix it. That is the cardinal rule. Okay, what about Kava's physical dangers? If it's not physical addiction and it doesn't cause respiratory depression, what is the risk?
With Kava, the risks are heavily concentrated in two specific organs, the skin and the liver.
Let's start with the skin.
If someone uses Kava very heavily, chronically, for a long period, like drinking massive amounts every single day, they can develop a condition called Kava dermopathy.
Dermopathy. It sounds like a lizard. What does that actually look like?
The skin becomes extremely dry, scaly, and takes on a yellowish tint. It can look quite severe, almost like an intense eczema. But the good news is that it is completely 100% reversible.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as the person stops drinking Kava or dramatically lowers their dose, the skin sheds the scales and clears up completely within a few weeks. It's a cosmetic indicator that you are drinking too much.
Okay, dry, scaly skin I can handle. I'll just use moisturizer. But you also mentioned the liver. And liver failure is terrifying. It's fatal.
It is, and this is, without a doubt, the most serious risk associated with Kava, though it is statistically rare. There have been documented cases of serious and occasionally fatal hepatotoxicity liver injury linked to kava products.
I really want to dig into this because I remember in the early 2000s, this liver issue caused a massive global panic. Several major European countries like Germany and Switzerland actually banned kava completely because people were suffering liver damage.
They did.
What exactly happened there? Were the traditional Pacific Islanders just ignoring generations of liver failure?
That is the perfect question to ask. Because the answer reveals so much about the dark side of the modern supplement industry. No, the traditional Pacific Islanders were not dropping dead of liver failure.
Okay.
The crisis happened when the plant moved west. When researchers and hepatologists really dug into those European liver injuries in the 2000s, they uncovered a massive corporate scandal.
A scandal?
The injuries were largely tied to terrible product quality, corporate greed, and modern corner-cutting extraction methods.
Break that down. What did the Western companies change?
For thousands of years, Pacific Islanders have followed two strict rules. First, they only use the underground root of specific high-quality strains of the plant called noble kava. Second, they extract the active compounds using only cold water. They pound the root, mix it with water, and strain it.
Root only, water only.
Root only, water only. But in the late 90s and early 2000s, the Western supplement boom was in full swing. European and American pharmaceutical and supplement manufacturers wanted to make stronger, cheaper, hyper-concentrated kava pills to sell as natural anxiety remedies. So they broke both ancient rules to save money.
What did they do?
First, instead of just using the expensive underground root, they started buying up the cheap, leftover aerial parts of the plant from farmers, the stems, the peelings, and the leaves.
But didn't you say earlier that the leaves are toxic?
Yes. The aerial parts of the kava plant contain completely different chemical compounds called flavocoins, which are highly toxic to human liver cells.
You're kidding.
The Pacific Islanders throw those parts away. The Western supplement companies ground them up and put them in pills.
That is borderline criminal. They poison their own customers to save a few cents on the dollar.
It gets worse. The second thing they changed was the extraction method. They didn't want to use water because water is inefficient. It leaves some of the kava lactones behind.
They wanted more bang for their buck.
They wanted 100% yield. So they started using harsh chemical solvents like acetone and pure ethanol alcohol to extract the compounds.
Like nail polish remover.
Exactly. And this chemical extraction process pulled out heavy, fat-soluble compounds that traditional water extraction naturally leaves behind in the plant fiber. They created a fundamentally different, highly concentrated chemical matrix that the human liver was not equipped to process.
So the European bans in the 2000s were based on these Frankenstein solvent-extracted stem pills, not the traditional water-extracted root used in the kava circle.
Precisely. It was a crisis of manufacturing, not a crisis of the botanical root itself. And once the scientific community realized this, and the World Health Organization released reports clarifying the data, many of those European bans were actually overturned or modified.
Right.
Germany, for instance, reversed its ban. The courts realized it was a failure of the unregulated supplement industry, not a failure of the kava root.
That story is wild. It's corporate espionage mixed with botanical ignorance. But here is where it gets incredibly relevant to our listeners right now. Because right now, in the summer of 2026, we are seeing a massive regulatory panic happen all over again with the exact same themes of corporate greed and artificial concentration.
History repeating itself.
But this time, the target isn't kava. The target is kratom. Let's talk about the July 2026 7OH crackdown.
This is the most urgent, high-stakes piece of news in this entire space, and it is wildly misunderstood by the general public and the media.
I see the headlines on my newsfeed every day. DEA moves to ban kratom epidemic. Break it down for us, because based on what we just discussed about the traditional leaf, those headlines aren't entirely accurate, are they?
They are highly misleading. Regulators, specifically the FDA and the DEA, are not currently launching a total war against the natural, raw kratom leaf.
Right.
To understand the crackdown, we have to go back to the chemistry we discussed earlier. Remember the two alkaloids, metrogenine and 7-OH.
Right. Metrogenine is the partial agonist, and 7-OH is the much stronger one.
Exactly. In a natural, raw kratom leaf plucked off a tree, 7-OH makes up a microscopic fraction of the alkaloid profile. We are talking about less than 2% of the total alkaloids.
Barely.
It is barely a trace amount. The natural plant relies primarily on metrogenine.
So what changed? Why is the DEA freaking out in 2026?
Because modern supplement manufacturers ran the exact same playbook they used on kava in the 2000s. They figured out how to manipulate the chemistry. Over the last few years, underground chemists and supplement manufacturers figured out how to isolate, artificially concentrate, and even synthetically convert mitragynine into pure 7-OH.
Wait, they are synthesizing it, like in a lab?
Yes. Through an oxidation process, they are converting the mild alkaloid into the hyperpotent alkaloid. And the reason they are focusing on 7-OH is terrifying. 7-OH is vastly, exponentially more potent at the mu opioid receptor than mitragynine.
Oh, boy.
In fact, the FDA commissioner recently released a stark public statement warning that this concentrated 7-OH compound can be up to 13 times more potent than morphine.
13 times more potent than morphine, and they're putting this into consumer products.
They're putting this highly concentrated semi-synthetic 7-OH into brightly colored gummies, liquid energy shots, and sublingual tablets.
Insane.
They are branding it with the word kratom to piggyback on the natural leaf's legal gray area, and they are selling it at gas stations right next to the breath mints and energy drinks, with absolutely no age restrictions in many states.
That is apocalyptic. It's essentially unregulated, hyperpotent, semi-synthetic opioid gummies masquerading as a harmless botanical supplement. Kids could buy this.
And kids have bought it, which is exactly why the hammer dropped. On July 1st, 2026, the DEA initiated an emergency temporary process to place these specific concentrated 7-OH products, along with several other synthetic kratom derivatives like pseudoindoxal, into Schedule 3rd of the Controlled Substances Act.
Schedule 1, just to remind everyone, that is the most restrictive category in federal law. That is the same legal category as heroin, LSD, and ecstasy.
Yes. The DEA and state health officials are explicitly warning that the mass distribution of these 7-OH concentrates has the potential to trigger a fourth wave of the opioid epidemic. But again, the crucial nuance that everyone misses is that the DEA is using a scalpel, not a sledgehammer.
Right.
They are targeting the artificially concentrated extracts and the synthetic derivatives. As of right now, they are leaving the natural leaf alone.
So despite all this drama, the natural kratom leaf is still legal federally.
Federally, yes. The natural leaf remains unscheduled. However, the DEA officially lists it as a drug of concern, and the FDA absolutely refuses to allow it to be sold as an approved dietary supplement or food additive. They use import alerts to seize massive shipments at the border. But the federal government hasn't made possession of the leaf a crime. The states, however, are a completely different story.
The map of state laws must be a chaotic patchwork.
It is an incredibly messy, constantly shifting patchwork. Kratom is banned outright Schedule R in a handful of states, places like Alabama, Arkansas, Indiana, and Wisconsin.
So what happens there?
If you are caught with kratom leaf in Alabama, you face felony drug possession charges. Though, interestingly, some of those states are currently facing intense lobbying to reconsider those bans.
What are the other states doing? Are they just letting it stay the Wild West?
No, many states are trying a third way. They are passing legislation called Kratom Consumer Protection Acts, or KCPAs.
What does a KCPA actually do?
Instead of banning the leaf and creating a black market, KCPAs attempt to regulate it like alcohol or tobacco. They mandate age limits, making it illegal to sell to anyone under 18 or 21. They require mandatory independent lab testing for heavy metals and adulterants.
Well, that makes sense.
They cap the allowable amount of 7-OH to natural levels, essentially outlawing the synthetic gummies. And they require honest, accurate labeling. It's a harm reduction approach. But regardless of whether a state bans it or regulates it, the overarching narrative for Kratom in 2026 is clear. The days of the unregulated Wild West are over. The legal noose is tightening rapidly.
And what about Kava? While all this opioid drama is happening with Kratom, how is the law treating our GABAergic peace pipe root?
The trajectory is the exact opposite. While Kratom is facing bans and DEA scheduling, Kava is experiencing a global renaissance.
Really?
Kava is completely legal across the United States. It is fully legal as a dietary supplement. It is sold openly in those botanical Kava bars we mentioned. Internationally, the laws are actively loosening.
Because the science finally cleared its name regarding the liver toxicity.
Exactly. The old European bans were largely overturned when the World Health Organization clarified that traditional water extraction of noble root is safe. And just recently, Australia, which has incredibly strict biosecurity and drug laws, actually liberalized its Kava import laws, allowing commercial importation for the first time in over a decade.
So if we pull back and look at the big picture here, Kratom is facing felony state bans, DEA emergency scheduling of its concentrates, and FDA import seizures. Meanwhile, Kava is seeing historical bans lifted, import markets opening up, and a boom in social botanical bars.
It's quite the contrast.
It all comes back to that very first thing we discussed, the mechanism, opioid versus GABA. The geopolitical laws are simply reacting to the underlying pharmacology.
Precisely. The legal divergence perfectly maps onto the biological divergence.
So we have covered an immense amount of ground today. We've covered the history of the Thai rubber plantations and the Pacific Kava circles. We've gone deep into the brain chemistry of partial agonists, voltage gates, and receptor downregulation. We've explored the fatal failure modes of polydrug toxicity and solvent-extracted liver damage.
We really went everywhere.
And we mapped the 2026 DEA crackdowns. But for you, the listener, how do you actually apply this mountain of knowledge? If you were standing in that store looking at these two beautifully packaged products, what is the harm reduction playbook?
It comes down to two things. Matching the plant to your specific physiological purpose and being ruthlessly, uncompromisingly honest with yourself about the biological risks you are willing to take.
Let's break it down by goal.
Okay, if your primary goal is relaxation, if you are looking for relief from situational, everyday anxiety, or if you're looking for an alcohol alternative for a Friday night that has the absolute lowest risk of causing a physical dependency or ruining your life,
then Kava is the clear answer.
Kava is vastly superior. It is the far more forgiving choice. It gives you that sociable, empathetic calm. It slows down your racing thoughts, but it does so without the lingering threat of an agonizing opioid withdrawal when you stop drinking it.
But what if someone is specifically seeking out Kratom? Maybe they are dealing with chronic fatigue or severe chronic pain that their doctor won't treat, or they are desperately trying to taper off of a heroin addiction and they feel they truly need it.
If you are making the conscious choice to use Kratom, you absolutely must respect its opioid nature. You cannot treat it like a cup of green tea or morning coffee.
Right.
You have to acknowledge its genuine habit-forming potential. You have to understand receptor downregulation, and you must treat it with the exact same caution, spacing, and respect you would apply to any pharmaceutical opioid.
Let's lay out the golden rules of safety for each. And just as a clear reminder to the listener, this is an educational breakdown of the available scientific literature, not medical advice. But based on the data, what are the absolute non-negotiables for a consumer? Let's start with Kratom.
Golden rule number one for Kratom. Absolutely, categorically avoid any concentrated 7-OH products. No gummies, no hyperpotent liquid shots, no colorful tablets. Stick exclusively to the natural, raw leaf powder.
What's rule two?
Rule number two. Only buy products from vendors that provide verifiable, independent, third-party lab testing. You must ensure you aren't consuming heavy metals, salmonella, or hidden synthetic adulterants.
And rule number three, which we established, is literally a matter of life and death.
Rule number three, never mix Kratom with other central nervous system depressants. No alcohol, no benzodiazepines, no other opioids, no sleeping pills. Remember, the data polydrug use is the primary driver of Kratom-associated fatalities. The compounding respiratory depression will kill you. Do not mix it.
Crystal clear. Treat it like a standalone drug, not a mixer. Now, what are the golden rules for Kava?
For Kava, rule number one is entirely about the physical product you buy. Only consume water extracted noble cultivar root. You must do your research on the brand.
Avoid the bad stuff.
Exactly. Avoid any product that uses alcohol, ethanol, or acetone solvent extracts. And absolutely avoid any product or cheap pill that uses the aerial parts, the stems, peelings, or leaves of the plant. That is where the flavoquines live. That is where the liver toxicity risk lies. Stick to the ancient method. Root and water.
Rule number two for Kava.
Rule number two. Just like Kratom, never combine Kava with alcohol or other pharmaceutical sedatives. Not only does combining them add dangerous levels of cognitive impairment and sedation, but processing both cavalactones and alcohol simultaneously puts a massive, unnecessary, and potentially dangerous strain on your liver enzymes. Keep them separate.
Noble root, extracted with water, consumed by itself. That's the Kava rule.
Exactly.
It is incredibly empowering to have this laid out so clearly because, again, if we go back to our starting point, they look completely identical on the shelf. The fonts are the same, the packaging is the same, the promises of natural relaxation are the same. But underneath that carefully curated marketing, there is a massive fundamental biological fault line that runs through this entire deep dive.
And if you take absolutely nothing else away from this hour of conversation, I want you to remember that fault line. Kratom is an opioid. Kava is a GABAergic.
It's just that simple.
Once you lock that single undeniable biological fact into your mind, everything else we've discussed, the vastly different physical effects, the terrifying addiction profiles, the lethal failure modes, and the rapidly diverging DEA and global legal crackdowns falls perfectly and logically into place.
It really does. It's the skeleton key that unlocks the whole mystery of the modern botanical market. Before we wrap up today, I want to turn it over to you for a final provocative thought. Something for the listener to mull over as they go about their day, building on what we've learned, but taking it one step further into how we navigate our current culture.
I want you to consider what this entire Kratom and Kava situation says about our modern wellness culture as a whole. We live in a society that currently allows a partial opioid agonist, a plant that can cause physical dependence, receptor downregulation, and agonizing withdrawal, to be packaged in the exact same earthy, soothing branding and sold on the exact same gas station shelf as a sacred ceremonial GABAergic root.
It's wild when you say it out loud like that.
It forces us to ask a really uncomfortable question about ourselves as consumers. Are we truly seeking genuine natural wellness and health? Or have we simply outsourced our critical thinking to aesthetic packaging, matte finish bottles, and marketing buzzwords?
We trust the font, not the pharmacology.
Exactly. Because the reality is, the FDA isn't standing in the aisle with you. Your doctor isn't at the botanical bar to check the label. The ultimate responsibility to know exactly what chemical compounds are crossing your blood-brain barrier and the lifelong consequences of that crossing rests entirely on your shoulders. You have to be your own advocate.
That is a phenomenal, sobering point to end on. You cannot judge a botanical by its modern, minimalist font. You have to know the science.
You really do.
A quick reminder to you, all this deep dive was purely educational. It is an analysis of the provided source material and is not medical, diagnostic, or substance use advice. If you or someone you know is struggling with substance use, dependency, or a mental health crisis, please contact SAMHSA's National Helpline at 1-800-662-HELP, or if you are in immediate crisis, reach out to the 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. There is help available. The next time you walk into that gas station or that trendy botanical bar and you see those two bottles sitting side by side, bathed in the neon light, you won't be fooled by the buzzwords. You know exactly what you're looking at. Stay curious, stay informed, and we'll see you on the next deep dive.